Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland. I'm your host Fraser, and today we're diving into episode 54, Alexander II, the King of Scots. In our previous episode, we wrapped up the compelling saga of William I, known as William the Lion. His reign was a rollercoaster of challenges and victories, marked by significant lows and extraordinary highs. Despite facing numerous adversities, William managed to affirm Scotland's sovereignty, a testament to his exceptional leadership and unyielding spirit. Today, we turn the pages of history to his son and heir, Alexander II. He was born in the year 1198. During a period of relative stability, Alexander II was thrust into leadership, bearing the legacy of his father's tumultuous yet triumphant reign in the end. The question that now looms large is whether his tenure as king would mirror the unpredictability of his father's, or would he navigate a course of peace and stability reminiscent of his uncle Malcolm IV. Alexander II's early years were marked by his upbringing in a royal household that was no stranger to the demands and intrigues of governance. Educated and groomed to rule, he witnessed firsthand the complexities of political manoeuvring and the weight of leadership that he was destined to inherit. His formative years, underscored by his experiences at the royal court in both England and Scotland, were pivotal in shaping his character and his approach to kingship. As we explore Alexander's transition from prince to king, we'll delve into the dynamics of his relationship with his father, the influence of his mother Ermengard, and the impact of his tutors who entrusted with his education. These relationships and his early experiences were crucial in moulding a king whose reign would be scrutinised against the backdrop of his father's formidable legacy. Will Alexander's reign be characterised by strife and struggles that often accompany his father's rule? Or will he steer Scotland towards a period of peace and prosperity? Well, there's only one way to find out. So, as we delve into this episode, grab your favourite hot drink, adjust your radio or headphones, and settle in as we embark on a journey back to the late 12th century, to the very beginning of Alexander II's life and ascension to the throne. Our story begins, however, with the birth of the only son and heir of William I. Alexander II was born in 1198 in Haddington, East Lothian, Scotland. The town, situated in a strategic location near Edinburgh, played a significant role in the medieval politics of Scotland and provided a fitting backdrop for the birth of a future king. Alexander was brought up during a period marked by his father, William I's resilience and political acumen. As the heir apparent, Alexander's education and grooming for kingship were of paramount importance. He was raised at the royal court, which was likely vibrant with political and cultural activities, providing a rich environment for a future king. Alexander's primary education was overseen by key figures at the royal court. Though specific names of his tutors are not extensively documented, it is likely that he was tutored by a mix of Scottish and possibly, for a first time this episode, French clerics, reflecting the strong cultural and political ties between Scotland and France at the time. These tutors would have provided him with an education in law, governance, warfare, and diplomacy, all essential for a king in waiting. From an early age, Alexander displayed traits of determination and intelligence. There are no specific records of him being particularly troubled. Rather, he seemed to have embraced his responsibilities with a level of seriousness and maturity. His upbringing under a powerful and respected king like William undoubtedly influenced his character, instilling a sense of duty and a keen understanding of the complexities of ruling a kingdom like Scotland. Alexander's childhood and teenage years were spent learning not just the arts of war and peace, but also understanding the dynamics of Scottish, English, and broader European politics. As part of the Treaty of Fairlouce and the later treaty with King John, an agreement that William had signed with Henry II of England in 1174, and then, as I mentioned, with King John, Alexander was sent to England as a form of assurance and to receive an education. He spent part of his youth under the King of England's guise. Under these circumstances, which was common practice among Scottish and English nobility, to foster mutual understanding and maintain peace agreements. A significant event during his time in England was when Alexander was knighted by King John of England at Clerkenwell Priory in 1213 AD. This ceremony was not only a rite of passage for Alexander, also served as proof of the Anglo-Scottish relations at the time. His knighthood in England was both a personal honour and a political statement, reflecting his status and the ongoing diplomatic relations between the two kingdoms. Alexander's time in England profoundly influenced his approach to dealing with the English kings. Being educated and knighted in England exposed him to the court life, politics, and military tactics of the English, and more importantly, King John. These were invaluable in his later dealings with the King of England and as himself as King. This experience provided him with insights into English strategies and thinking, which likely helped him in negotiations and in understanding the political landscape of his southern neighbour. Moreover, having personal relationships with members of the English royalty and nobility, including King John, could have facilitated smoother diplomatic relations. Well, initially. Alexander was known to have a relatively close relationship also with his father, William, as he was being groomed as his successor and often involved in matters of state from a young age. His mother, Ermengarde de Beaumont, would have also played a crucial role in his upbringing, particularly in his earlier years, influencing his character and values. However, less is documented about his relationships with his sisters, Margaret, Isabella, and Marjorie. Given the customs of the time, his interactions with his sisters might have been limited by their respective duties and marriages arranged for political alliances. Still, as royal siblings, they would have a shared bond of upbringing and mutual interests of the family and the kingdom. Well, when Alexander II heard news of his father's passing, William I, he was in Stirling. This moment was pivotal, as it marked the beginning of his journey from prince to king, carrying forward the legacy of his father's reign. The passing of William I in December 1214 left the young Alexander at the threshold of kingship, facing the immense responsibility of leading Scotland. Alexander was crowned King of Scotland shortly after his father's death on December 6, 1214. The crowning took place in the traditional ceremonious setting of Scone, a location steeped in Scottish royal history. Scone was not merely a venue, it was a symbol of Scottish sovereignty and the continuity of the royal lineage. As was customary, the ceremony involved Alexander being placed upon the Stone of Destiny, which had been used for the coronation of Scottish kings since time immemorial. The coronation was steeped in rich tradition, echoing the processes we explored, if you remember, at the start of William I's reign. The ceremony would have involved religious consecrations, anointing with holy oils, and the bestowment of regal symbols such as the crown, scepter, and sword, signifying the divine and temporal powers vested in the king. The nobles and clergy of Scotland would have gathered to witness and support the ascension of Alexander II, reaffirming their allegiance to the new king and the continuity of governance, and also the continuity of the House of Dunkeld. This ceremony was not just a ritual passage, but a crucial moment for consolidating power and asserting royal authority, especially important given the sometimes fractious nature of Scottish noble loyalties. Upon his ascension to the throne, these would be Alexander's first tasks: consolidating his authority and securing his position as the undisputed ruler of Scotland was sometimes up and down, but he managed to complete most of it. This included affirming loyalties among the Norman Scottish nobility, many of whom were powerful regional leaders by now with their own interests and allegiances. Alexander also needed to address the kingdom's defence and fortify its borders, particularly given the ongoing threats and tensions with King John of England. Another significant job was managing the kingdom's finances and administration, ensuring that Scotland remained stable and prosperous. Alexander II inherited a realm that was largely independent, but still recovering from previous conflicts. Thus, he needed to navigate these challenges with a blend of diplomatic skill and firm governance. Alexander held court and governed primarily from Edinburgh Castle. The historic fortress that by his reign had become a central hub of royal power and administration. Edinburgh Castle was not just a military stronghold, but also a symbol of the Scottish monarch's authority and presence. Its choice as its main seat of power reflects the strategic importance of Edinburgh as a city, positioned centrally within the kingdom and able to command both the lowlands and the approaches to the highlands. And this is going to be a recurring theme for all of our future kings. Additionally, Alexander may have used other locations, all for specific purposes, such as Stirling Castle for a strategic location near the Highlands and Scone Palace for ceremonial occasions, reflecting the intimate nature of medieval kingship. Alexander II became king at the age of 16, following his father's death in 1214. His young age at the time of his coronation meant that his early reign was likely guided by a group of advisers and regents who would have helped him manage the complexities of ruling a kingdom at such a young age. Despite his youth, however, his upbringing in a rural environment equipped him with the necessary skills and knowledge to take on the responsibilities of kingship. Some of these key advisers during his early reign and regents were Walter de Biddon. He served as Chancellor of Scotland from 1209 until his death in 1231. Given his long tenure in this role, he would have been a primary advisor and administrator under Alexander II, particularly in the early years of his reign. There was Walter Comyn, Lord of Bandock. Yes, this is the first time we hear the Commons. A powerful figure in the Scottish politics, Walter Comyn was part of the Regency government during the minority of Alexander II. His influence and extensive lands made him a key player in the governance and defence strategies of the kingdom. And the Comyn family will obviously be a key family to take note of in the future. And then there was William de Albany. He was appointed Justiciar of Scotia and was a crucial figure in the legal and judicial system of Scotland. His role would have involved advising the king on legal matters and implementing royal justice across the realm. And then there was Alan, Lord of Galloway. As a powerful regional lord, Alan of Galloway was instrumental in maintaining stability and enforcing the king's rule in the southwestern parts of Scotland, an area critical for controlling the Irish Sea and interactions with the English, and obviously a place that we've heard many rebellions being started. And then there was Thomas de Golville. As Justiciar of Scotia, Thomas was also being appointed a significant advisor, especially in the legal and military affairs. He played roles in the administration of law and order and the defence of the kingdom. These figures, among others, likely formed the core of Alexander II's council and provided governance, legal, military and administrative advice during his reign. Their experience and support during his early reign would have been crucial in helping the young king navigate the complexities of ruling and maintaining authority across Scotland. There was also, don't forget, Alexander II's mother, Irmgard de Beaumont, who would have also played a significant role in his early reign, especially given his young age when he ascended the throne. Irmgard, as we know, was a daughter of Richard, Viscount of Beaumont, Frisony, and was well connected within the Anglo-Norman aristocracy. Her marriage to William was part of a broader diplomatic relationship between England and Scotland. As Queen Consort and later as the Queen Mother, Irmgard would have brought her political insights, experience and connections to bear in advising and guiding her son during his initial years as king. Given the period's norms and the importance of lineage and royal bloodlines, her role in the court would not only have been as a maternal figure, but also as a key advisor in matters of state, particularly in maintaining alliances and managing relationships with other noble families both within Scotland and in neighbouring regions. Irmgard's influence would have been crucial in stabilising and providing continuity during the transition from William I's reign to that of Alexander. She likely had a hand in ensuring that the nobility supported her young son, and her presence would have been added as a bit of legitimacy and a sense of continuity in the early reign. Her background and understanding of both the Scottish side and the Anglo-Norman side would have been invaluable as she helped to mentor Alexander in his duties as king. But, as always, nothing is ever simple in the history of Scotland. There was a revolt. Yes, shock horror. The Mick Williams and the Mick Heath clans revolted against Alexander II's crowning, primarily due to the historical claims to the Scottish throne and opposition to the centralisation of royal power, which threatened their regional autonomy. These clans, having historical grievances and claims rooted in lineage and previous conflicts, saw the new young king's ascent as an opportune moment, yet again, to challenge the established order and assert their own claims. As a quick reminder, the McWilliam clan trace their descent from William FitzDuncan, the grandson of King Malcolm III of Scotland. They had a claim to the Scottish throne through William's father, King Duncan II, making their claim particularly potent during times of succession. The most notable leader of the McWilliams during this period was likely Donnchad McWilliam, who was a grandson of William FitzDuncan. His rebellion is one of the more documented ones, occurring around 1215 AD, right after the coronation. There was also the McHeaths, who were another prominent family with royal aspirations. They claimed descent from Malcolm McHeath, who had once been a contender for the Scottish crown during the 12th century. His descendants had a history of uprising against the Scottish monarchy, particularly during the periods of perceived vulnerability in the royal succession. For the McHeaths, a key figure during this time was Kenneth McHeath, who might have participated in or led the uprisings against Alexander II. The McWilliams had their primary power base in Moray. As always, a region in the northeast of Scotland, Moray was a frequent hotbed of rebellion against the Scottish crown, particularly due to its distance from central power bases and its own strong local identity and leadership structures. The McHeath clan also was based in the northern part of Scotland, including parts of Ross and Moray. These areas were strategically significant, yet challenging for Scottish kings to control fully, often giving rise to localised powers who could muster significant resistance against the central authority. The revolt by these clans represents a recurring theme in Scottish history, where regional powers would rise against the monarchy, particularly at times of succession, to reassert their independence or press their claims to wider authority. Alexander's response to these challenges was crucial in establishing his rule and would set the tone for how he would deal with nobility and regional dissent during his reign. Alexander II dealt with the revolts of both the McHeaths and McWilliam clans decisively, demonstrating both military and strategic acumen. He mobilised royalist forces, which likely included loyal nobles and their armed retainers, to suppress these uprisings. The approach was assertive and aimed at quickly quelling any challenges to his authority to prevent them from gaining momentum or wider support. The king's response involved not only direct military confrontation, but also strategic fortifications and establishment of royal authority in continuous regions. By installing loyalists in key positions and fortifying his presence in strategic locations such as Moray and Ross, Alexander sought to assert and maintain royal control over these historically rebellious areas throughout his reign. So with the revolt crushed by royalist forces that Alexander II helped muster, there was obviously the fate of both Donnchad and Kenneth. Well, Donnchad led the significant uprising, but he was defeated by royalist forces. He was killed in 1215 AD, and his head was reportedly sent to King Alexander II as proof of the suppression of the revolt. This brutal end was intended to serve as a warning to others who might consider rebelling against the crown. Kenneth's specific fate isn't well documented in historical texts, but typical responses to such revolts included execution or imprisonment. Members of the McHeath family had a history of being imprisoned for their revolts in earlier reigns, and similar harsh penalties would have been likely under Alexander II as well. The severe treatment of these leaders underlined Alexander II's approach to governance, which, while often necessary to maintain royal authority, also perpetuated cycles of rebellion among the Highland clans. The suppression of these clan leaders helped stabilise Alexander's reign in the short term, but also sowed seeds of resentment that would occasionally flare up in later generations as always. These events highlight the ongoing struggle between the central Scottish monarchy and the more independent-minded clan leaders of the Highlands. And as I keep telling you all, this will not be the last time we touch upon rebellious clans against the crown. As the saying goes, war never changes. And down south in England erupted in another civil war in England. This war was called the First Barons' War in England. A significant historical conflict began as a result of deep-seated dissent among the English nobility with King John's rule, culminating in 1215 AD. But whilst Alexander II was putting down his own revolts, the war started after the failure of King John to adhere to the terms of the Magna Carta, which he had signed under a considerable pressure from the barons on 15th of June 1215. The Magna Carta were designed to limit the king's power and protect the rights of the barons, including provisions for due process and limits on royal taxation. However, King John, seeking to retain his autocratic power, soon sought annulment of the document from the Pope, this Pope being Pope Innocent III, who declared the Magna Carta null and void in August 1215. Feeling betrayed and facing ongoing oppression policies, the barons renounced their fealty to John in September 1215, leading to open rebellion yet again. Some of the key leaders were Robert Fitzwalter. Often regarded as a leader of the baronial forces, Fitzwalter played a pivotal role in the revolt. He was named Marshal of Army of God and Holy Church, reflecting the religious overtones that the barons adopted to legitimise their rebellion. There was also Sayer de Quincey, the Earl of Winchester. As one of the leaders, de Quincey was instrumental in drafting the Magna Carta and later in leading military actions during this war. His commitment to the baronial cause was rooted in both political ideology and personal opposition to John's rule. There was also William de Mowbray. Another prominent baron, de Mowbray's involvement was crucial, particularly in the northern regions of England. His support helped broaden the geographical scope of the rebellion. These leaders, among others, represented a cross-section of the English nobility, who were not just united against their grievances against King John, but also by their shared interest in maintaining feudal rights and limiting the monarch's power. Their leadership during the First Barons' War was pivotal in sustaining the conflict against the crown. Alexander II, after he dealt with the rebellions, decided to engage in the Baron War against King John. By siding with the English barons, he was driven by multiple strategic and political motivations, reflecting the complex interplay between Scottish ambitions and English instability. At the time, Alexander was a relatively new king, keen on asserting Scottish sovereignty and expanding his influence like his father. By siding with the barons, he could capitalise on the turmoil in England to press Scottish claims and perhaps regain territories lost under previous monarchs. The conflict presented a unique opportunity for Alexander to strengthen his position relative to England without direct provocation, as he was not the instigator of the conflict, but rather a supporter of an existing rebellion. Alexander's decision to join the barons also had a historical precedent. The Scottish monarchy had a long history of involvement in English affairs, as we know, well, with his father and the Treaty of Fairlouce. In 1215, following the formal outbreak of hostilities after the barons renounced their allegiance to King John, Alexander mustered his forces and led an army into the Kingdom of England in support of the barons. This move was bold and calculated, demonstrating Alexander's willingness to engage in significant military and political manoeuvres to secure and enhance Scotland's interests in the region. His participation in the conflict marked a significant moment in English-Scottish relations, yet again showing that Scotland under his rule would actively influence outcomes in England, not merely react to them. Alexander's decision to intervene, however, was responded to, shall we say, by John, who retaliated by sacking Berwick-upon-Tweed and ravaging the north. It underscored the risks of Alexander's involvement in English affairs. The response from Scottish nobles and clans varied, reflecting a range of perspectives on the king's foreign policy. Some Scottish nobles likely viewed Alexander's decision to support the English barons as a strategic move, aimed at weakening a common adversary and potentially gaining territorial concessions. Other older nobles probably remembered what happened to his father and didn't want to risk the same happening to him. there was a risk versus reward, and this debate among the Scottish nobility and clans would have centred on the balance between the potential rewards of weakening King John's position in England against the risks to the Scottish border regions. Moreover, there would have been concerns about national security and the readiness of Scotland to face a potential full-scale English invasion if the conflict escalated further, the capacity of Scottish forces to defend the kingdom whilst also engaging offensively in England would have been a critical concern for the Scottish military and political leadership. The Barren War came to an end largely due to the death of King John in October 1216, which significantly shifted the political landscape. Following his death, the English crown passed to his 9-year-old son, Henry III, under the regency of William Marshall, who was a respected knight and statesman. Marshall moved quickly to reissue the Magna Carta in a slightly revised form in 1217, addressing some of the barons' grievances and thereby weakening their resolve to continue the conflict. The strategic move, combined with Marshall's adept negotiation, led many rebels to reconsider their stance and gradually return their allegiance to the young Henry III. Alexander's involvement in the conflict led him to the port of Dover in September 1216. Yes, that far south, the furthest a Scottish king had come so far. He made a significant political gesture by paying homage to Louis of France. Louis had been invited by the rebellious barons to take the English throne as a way to oust King John, who they deemed unfit to rule. The barons' choice of Louis was strategic, leveraging his power as a French king to lend greater weight to their military campaign against John. Alexander's decision to pay homage to Louis was motivated by the need to secure Scottish interests and recognition in this new, potentially shifting balance of power. By acknowledging Louis as the ruler over the lands in England, Alexander was not only supporting the barons' choice, but also ensuring that Scotland was seen as a key player in the broader political drama unfolding across Britain. This move was also intended to solidify alliances and secure favourable terms for Scotland. Following these dramatic events at Dover and the homage to Louis of France, the political landscape shifted significantly further when more nobles became to flock to the young son of John, Henry III, who ascended to the throne under, as I said, the regency of William the Marshal. The papacy, keen on maintaining stability and its influence in England, supported the young king. This endorsement by the papacy, along with Marshal's diplomatic efforts, prompted a realignment of loyalties among the English aristocracy. The support for Louis began to wane as many barons opted to back the legitimate heir to solidify their own positions within the realm and ensure the continuity of governance. This shift forced the French and Scottish armies to reconsider their positions. The consolidation of support around Henry III and the renowned assurance of Magna Carta in 1217, which addressed many of the barons' concerns, undermined the justification for continued foreign intervention. Consequently, both the French and Scottish forces found themselves in an untenable position and began to withdraw, returning to their respective homelands. The formalisation of peace came with the Treaty of Kingston on the 12th of September 1217. This treaty was a significant diplomatic achievement that formally ended hostilities between Henry III, Louis and Alexander II. The treaty likely included provisions that restored rights and properties, solidified borders and laid down terms for future interactions among their nations. By the way, this Louis is Louis VIII of France. It represented a pivotal moment of reconciliation that helped stabilise relations across the English Channel and the Anglo-Scottish borders. Diplomatic ties were further strengthened when Alexander II married Joan, the sister of Henry III, on either the 18th of June or the 25th of June 1221. This marriage was not merely a union of two individuals, but a strategic alliance that cemented the peace established by the Treaty of Kingston. Marriages in this period were crucial diplomatic tools, as we know, used to solidify alliances and ensure peace between the realms. The marriage of Alexander to Joan symbolised a commitment to peaceful relations and cooperation between Scotland and England, which was especially significant given the tumultuous events of the previous years. Through these diplomatic manoeuvres and strategic marriages, Alexander II demonstrated a keen understanding on the broader geopolitical landscape. These actions helped him to ensure a period of relative peace and stability, allowing him to focus on internal governance and the consolidation of the power within Scotland, which were obviously crucial for his reign. But who was Joan? Well, Joan, also known as Joan of England, was born in 1210, and she was the daughter of King John of England and Isabella. Her birthplace was likely Colchester, England, where she was part of the royal family that held significant influence across the British Isles. Growing up in a politically turbulent period, Joan's life and marriage were destined to be intertwined with broader political strategies. The marriage between Joan and Alexander II took place, as I said, on either the 18th of June or the 25th of June 1221, shortly after the peace settlements concluded of her father's reign. While historical records about the personal aspects of their marriage are limited, the union is generally considered to have been a politically motivated arrangement that aimed to solidify peace and alliance between Scotland and England. Despite its political nature, there are indications here and there that the marriage was a harmonious one, with Joan being received warmly in Scotland and played her part as Queen Consort effectively. The marriage between Joan and Alexander was a significant diplomatic success. It symbolised a bond between the two nations that went beyond mere political convenience, representing a familial tie that both countries would help to lead to a lasting peace. By marrying the sister of the English king, Alexander reinforced the Treaty of Kingston's commitments and fostered a personal connection with the English royal family yet again. This alliance helped stabilise the regions and provide a framework for cooperation and peace that was beneficial to both kingdoms. The marriage was instrumental in ushering in a period of relative calm and cooperation between Scotland and England, which contrasted sharply with the preceding years of conflict and tension. It allowed Alexander to focus on more decisive affairs against maybe the Kingdom of Norway, which we'll have a look at in next week's episode. And we'll also dive deeper into the life of Queen Joan next week. We'll explore her role within the English court, her influence on Scottish affairs, and the legacy of her time as Queen. Her story is not just one of political alliance, but also of personal strength in navigating the complex landscape of medieval royalty. But, as always, that was certainly a dramatic beginning to a new King of Scotland's reign, wasn't it? Alexander's useful ascension to the throne at the tender age of 16 to his strategic manoeuvrings on the broader European stage, Alexander truly seemed to have jumped straight into the deep end. His decisions not only defined his early reign, but also set the stage for the complex and dynamic leadership that would come to characterise his time as king. As we've seen, his alliances and conflicts, especially those involving the English and the French, illustrate a monarch who was as much as a warrior as he was a knight. His actions not only impacted Scotland, but also the balance of power in medieval Britain. It's clear that Alexander was not only to sit passively by, he was actively shaping his legacy from the very start. But there's much more to the story of Alexander II, a king whose epithets as the warrior and the knight only hint at the multifaceted ruler he was. In our next week's episode, we'll dive deeper into why he earned these titles and explore the later years of his reign, where his strategies and battles further defined his legacy and shaped Scottish history. As always, remember our podcasts are released weekly with 3 episodes each month, bringing you rich and vibrant tales from Scotland's story past. Be sure to tune in next week for another engaging episode. In the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at TheHistoryOfSC1, that is, at TheHistoryOfSC1, or check out our Facebook page at The History of Scotland Podcast. We love hearing from you, so please leave a review on your favourite podcasting platform, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or many other great podcasting sites. But as always, thank you for joining us today and for being such a wonderful audience. Have a fantastic week, guys, and we'll meet again soon to continue our journey through the history of Scotland. But until then, stay safe and goodbye for now. Peace.